Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 188. It's Monday, November 21st. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, we're still heating up with infectious respiratory disease season. You can take your pick, RSV, flu, or COVID. Fortunately, COVID deaths have dipped to a year-long low of under 300 per day, but unfortunately, hospitalizations and such are inching up, so we may have a triple-demic here. And it does look like flu is hitting particularly hard. This from CNBC. Flu variant that hits kids and seniors harder than other strains is dominant in U.S. right now. A variant of the flu that hits kids and seniors worse than other strains of the virus is dominant in the U.S. right now, setting the country up for potentially bad flu season. Public health labs have detected influenza A, H3N2, in 76% of the more than 3,500 respiratory samples that have tested positive for the flu and were analyzed for the virus subtype, according to a surveillance report published Friday by CDC. The H3N2 variant has been associated with more severe flu seasons for children and elderly in the past, according to Dr. Jose Romero, director of CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Disease. There are also early signs of influenza causing severe illness in precisely these two groups of individuals this season, Romero told reporters. At least 4.4 million people have fallen ill with the flu, 38,000 have been hospitalized, and 2,100 have died since the season started. Seven kids have died from the flu so far this season. When we have more H3N2, we usually have a more severe flu season. So longer duration, more children affected, more children with severe disease, said Dr. Andy Shane, a pediatrician infectious disease expert at Children's Healthcare in Atlanta. The CDC recommends that everyone 6 months or older get a flu shot. Children younger than age 8 who are receiving the vaccine for the first time should get two doses for the best protection. The flu vaccine is normally 40 to 60% effective at preventing illness, but people who do still get sick are less likely to end up in the hospital or die. Public health officials are also encouraging people to stay home when they are sick, cover coughs and sneezes, and wash hands frequently. Those who want to take extra precautions consider wearing a face mask indoors in public. And of course, this is great for COVID too. And if you remember the last two winters, flu was almost non-existent because face coverings were actually fairly common and wiped out the flu. Okay, well, next up from the Columbus Dispatch, a follow-up to a continuing story developing from last week. Columbus measles outbreak swells to 24 cases as 9 kids are hospitalized. A measles outbreak first reported last week in Columbus has grown yet again, public health officials are reporting. The outbreak, which began as 4 infections before growing to 15, has now increased to at least 24 cases at 7 child care facilities and 2 schools, said Kelly Newman, spokeswoman for Columbus Public Health. All 24 children were unvaccinated for the measles, and so far 9 have been hospitalized. One of the children infected is 6 years old, and the others are all age 4 or younger. Although preventable through vaccination, the measles is considered a dangerous and sometimes deadly disease. Even one shot can be up to 90% effective at preventing someone from falling ill with the measles. The latest outbreak brings the total number of measles cases reported in the Columbus area since June to 28. At least 5 outbreaks have been reported nationwide this year as of October 28th. Despite the growing number of measles infections in Columbus, the outbreaks still fall short of the largest in the last decade. In 2019, 1,274 cases were reported in 31 states, according to the CDC. Ohio reported one case in Stark County as part of that 2019 outbreak. And in another infectious disease news report that's rather interesting, this from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, Arizona's Maricopa County reports local dengue case. The Maricopa County Public Department, County Department of Public Health in Arizona, this week reported a dengue infection in someone who was probably exposed to infected mosquito in Maricopa County. Mosquito surveillance has detected dengue virus in a mosquito trap in one of the county's neighborhoods. Health officials are distributing free at-home blood tests in the neighborhood and are looking for more virus in mosquito traps in the rest of the county. The county is stepping up efforts to educate people on how to prevent the disease. The case appears to be the first locally acquired dengue infection in Maricopa County. All earlier infections have been linked to international travel. Also, the case appears to be the first local dengue infection on the U.S. mainland outside of Florida, which has reported 41 such cases this year. In its background information, the CDC said most outbreaks in the United States have been small and limited, but the types of mosquitoes that spread the virus are in many parts of the country, posing a risk of local spread. So this story, while in of itself is not any great health threat, it's on the cutting edge of our changing environment, largely due to climate change, and we're seeing mosquito vector-borne diseases coming up farther north as climates warm. So welcome dengue to Maricopa County, Phoenix, Arizona. Okay, well, next up we have some good news. This from Associated Press. USDA program keeps extra COVID-era money for fruits and veggies. U.S. agriculture officials proposed changes last Thursday to the federal program that helps pay the grocery bill for low-income pregnant women, babies, and young children, including extending a bump in payments for fresh fruits and vegetables allowed during the COVID-19 pandemic. The update also adds more whole grains, canned fish, and non-dairy options to their shopping carts. The effort is aimed at expanding the number and type of healthy foods available to families who get assistance from the Agriculture Department's program known as WIC. The revisions would make permanent payments authorized by Congress during the COVID-19 pandemic that increase vouchers for fruits and vegetables to $25 a month for children age 1 to 5 and $49 a month for breastfeeding women. This increase in fruits and vegetables has really made it attractive for families to have their children in the program longer, said Geraldine Henchy, Director of Nutrition Policy for the nonprofit Food Research and Action Center, who applauded the changes. Kids really love fruit. At the same time, the plan would reduce the amount of some foods, for example, reducing or limiting juice allowed for some recipients. It also reduces the amount of milk and cheese covered under the program, a move that drew immediate criticism from the dairy industry. Surprise, surprise. More than 6.2 million pregnant women, mothers, babies, and young children participate in the program annually. The federal government currently pays about $5 billion a year to run the program, which is administered through states and other jurisdictions. The Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children provides vouchers to mothers and children who qualify and specifically lists the amounts and types of foods they can buy. The proposed change to WIC would also expand access to whole grains, encompassing foods from different cultures, including quinoa, blue cornmeal, and teff, an ancient East African cereal grass. The plan also allows more non-dairy options, including soy-based yogurts and cheeses, and requires lactose-free milk to be included. It reflects the fact that different people have different capacities to tolerate different kinds of food, Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack said. More canned fish, such as tuna, would be available, as well as easy-to-prepare canned beans in addition to dried beans, officials said. The plan would also change the amount of infant formula provided to partially breastfed babies. Increasing the voucher for fruits and vegetables to $25 a month during the pandemic has allowed Elizabeth Loya, 28, of Los Angeles, to encourage her 4-year-old daughter, Giselle, to sample new foods. She tried Brussels sprouts, and 2 weeks ago she tried asparagus, Loya said. She liked them. The proposed changes are based on a 2017 report from the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine and the National Dietary Guidelines for Americans. They'll be evaluated after a 3-month public comment period. Okay, well, next up, some disturbing news. This from CNN. More adolescent e-cigarette users report vaping within 5 minutes of waking up, new study finds. Although the prevalence of e-cigarette use among teens has declined in recent years, those who do vape are starting younger and they're using e-cigarettes more intensely, a new study suggests. Among adolescents who use e-cigarettes, the percentage who use the product within the first 5 minutes of waking up in a day was less than 1% between the years 2014 and 2017, but that shifted to over 10% from 2017 through 2021, according to a new study in the medical journal JAMA Network Open. More than 2 million U.S. teens use e-cigarettes, a quarter of them daily, the CDC and FDA find. This increase in intensity may reflect increasing use of nicotine for self-medication in response to increases in adolescent depression, anxiety, tic disorders, and suicidality that occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic, the researchers from San Francisco and Massachusetts General Hospital wrote in the study. The pandemic has also been a lost year for school-based prevention and treatment efforts, meaning that abatement plans will need to be intensified to address the nicotine addiction in those adolescents who missed a year of contact with adults who might have otherwise helped them get treatment. Among adolescents who currently use any type of tobacco product, the proportion who first ever use of product at a young age was e-cigarette increased from 27% in 2014 to 78% in 2019 and remained at 77% in 2021. The overall prevalence of e-cigarette use peaked in 2019 and then declined, but by 2019, more e-cigarette users were using within the first 5 minutes of waking up each day compared with traditional cigarette users. The changes detected in the survey may reflect the higher levels of nicotine delivery and addiction liability of modern e-cigarettes that use protonated nicotine to make nicotine easier to inhale, the researchers wrote. The increasing intensity of use of modern e-cigarettes highlights the clinical need to address youth addiction to these new high nicotine products over the course of many clinical encounters. In addition, stronger regulations, including comprehensive bans on the sale of flavored tobacco products, should be implemented. This study's findings suggest that e-cigarettes may be putting a new generation of adolescents at risk for nicotine addiction. And research has shown that many adolescents are unaware that most e-cigarettes contain nicotine, said Ashley Marianos, a research affiliate member of Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center and the Third Hand Smoke Research Consortium, who is not involved in the new study. It is encouraging that the prevalence of e-cigarette use has declined among U.S. adolescents from 2019 to 21. However, the addiction intensity of use trends reported in this study are concerning, especially since tobacco use is typically established during adolescence, Marianos, who is also a faculty researcher at the University of Cincinnati, said. Unfortunately, early nicotine addiction could overturn the significant tobacco control progress made over many decades. Currently, cigarette smoking is at a record low among U.S. adolescents, but the continued initiation and use of e-cigarettes among adolescents could halt this progress. In 2020, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration banned flavored cartridge-based e-cigarettes other than tobacco or menthol from the market. But the researchers noted in their study that after the ban, disposable flavored e-cigarettes rapidly gained popularity among adolescents, and they are calling for clinicians to be on alert for possible cases of nicotine addiction among young people. And next up, another drug-related story, this from Associated Press. U.S. overdose deaths may be peaking, but experts are wary. Have U.S. drug overdose deaths stopped rising? Preliminary government data suggests they may have, but many experts are urging caution, noting that past plateaus didn't last. U.S. overdose deaths began steadily climbing in the 1990s, driven by opioid painkillers, followed by waves of deaths led by other opioids like heroin and, most recently, illicit fentanyl. Last year, more than 107,000 Americans died of drug overdoses, the highest tally in U.S. history. Last Wednesday, the CDC released provisional data on what happened through the first 6 months of this year. The news appears to be hopeful. Provisional data indicates U.S. overdose deaths fell 3 months in a row. The CDC estimated there were about 107,600 overdose deaths for the past 12-month period between July 2021 and June 2022. That's 40 fewer than the 2021 calendar year. Indeed, the decline is uneven. Only 8 states reported fewer overdose deaths, while all the others showed continued increases. And only 4 states, Maryland, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, reported sizable overdose deaths, decreases of 100 or more, compared with the previous year's period. Those few states, which have had some of the nation's highest overdose death rates, appear to be at the root of the national improvement this year, said Brandon Marshall, a Brown University public health researcher who tracks overdose trends. Officials in the 4 states said there's no single explanation, but they believe recent efforts may be paying off. They cite social media and health education campaigns to warn the public about the dangers of drug use, expanded addiction treatment, and wider distribution of the overdose-reversing medication naloxone. Some researchers are doubtful overdoses have peaked. Instead, they think a spike occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic when lockdowns and other restrictions isolated those with drug addictions and made treatment harder to get. We may be just returning to a pre-COVID level. I think you'll need at least a year more of data to confirm that, said Aaron Winston-Lee, a West Virginia University researcher focused on the overdose epidemic's health effects. The numbers are not close to pre-pandemic levels yet. Nationally, the July 2021 to June 22 estimated numbers of death is still more than 5% higher than the numbers in July 2020 to June 2021, and 28% higher than in the pre-pandemic July 2019 to June 2020. Deaths from illicit drugs are not only a public health crisis, but also a political issue. About three-quarters of voters in the midterm elections this month said they were concerned about the use of opioids in their community, including about a third who were very concerned, according to an Associated Press VoteCast, a survey of more than 94,000 midterm voters nationwide. Researchers have seen false plateaus before. Overdose deaths seemed to be leveling off for a couple of months in the spring of 2021 before rising again. There may also be lessons from 2018. That year, there were about 67,000 U.S. drug overdose deaths, a 4% drop from 2017. The numbers were celebrated with President Donald Trump declaring, quote, "We are curbing the opioid epidemic." Officials attributed the improvement to tougher policies, treatment program expansions, policies to limit opioid painkiller prescriptions, and wider distribution of naloxone. But some University of Pittsburgh researchers later concluded the improvement was largely the result of a 2017 change in China's regulation of the powerful opioid carfentanil. That change cut U.S. supplies of the drug and was followed by dramatic declines in overdose deaths in a handful of states. Researchers who doubted that 2018 heralded the start of an enduring decline turned out to be right. The numbers rose in 2019 and then soared when the COVID-19 pandemic hit. You can't celebrate every time you see a slight downturn. And one more thing making dealing with the opioid overdose epidemic difficult, this from Stat News. Fentanyl isn't just causing overdoses, it's making it harder to start addiction treatment. Doctors are reporting a troubling trend when it comes to fentanyl. The powerful drug, they say, isn't just causing overdoses, it's also making it more difficult to begin addiction treatment. In particular, fentanyl appears more likely to cause severe withdrawal symptoms for patients put on buprenorphine, a key medication used to treat opioid use disorder. The development adds yet another layer of crisis to the country's drug epidemic, which killed nearly 108,000 Americans last year. Even as fentanyl sends overdose deaths soaring, it threatens to make the world's most prescribed addiction drug inaccessible to the increasing number of patients who need it. "It's a clinical challenge of my career," said Sarah Kawasaki, an addiction doctor and psychiatry professor at Pennsylvania State University. "Inductions, or the process of starting patients on buprenorphine treatment, have become progressively more difficult in the past 5 years," she said, "as fentanyl has spread through the drug supply." To make matters worse, Kawasaki added, buprenorphine is one of just two medications commonly prescribed to treat opioid addiction. The other, methadone, is highly regulated. Patients can only access it at specialized clinics that typically require them to appear in person each day to receive a single dose. "We have 20 different ways to stop strep throat, but two medications that work well in the treatment of opioid use disorder," Kawasaki said. "When you eliminate one and make the other really hard to get, it's a setup for failure." While doctors across the U.S. and Canada, where fentanyl is also persuasive, have reported that buprenorphine inductions have become more difficult in recent years, the phenomenon is hard to measure or explain. Theories include fentanyl's raw potency, or that it is lipophilic, that is, it sticks to fat molecules and remains in the body for longer than other opioids. Buprenorphine is what's known as a partial agonist, meaning that it binds tightly but incompletely to the same brain receptors that give a euphoric effect when opioids bind to them. But it binds to the receptor awkwardly, like a puzzle piece that doesn't quite fit. As a result, patients with opioids already in their system can feel what's known as a precipitated withdrawal as the addiction medication shoves the fentanyl aside. As a result, it's normal for doctors to wait several hours until patients start experiencing withdrawal symptoms before they administer buprenorphine. At that point, the The BUP, as it's known, helps to treat withdrawal symptoms like anxiety or gastrointestinal distress, as well as eliminate future opioid cravings. With fentanyl, however, doctors are sometimes forced to wait a full day, if not longer, to make sure buprenorphine doesn't cause severe discomfort. In some cases, even patients experiencing withdrawal because they refrain from the drug use for many hours, typically ideal candidates for buprenorphine, find that their symptoms get worse, not better, once they begin using the medication. Many don't come back for another dose, known in doctors' parlance as a failed induction. Doctors warn those failed attempts can be dangerous, not just because they risk patients returning to fentanyl use, but also because those patients might feel so miserable that they refuse to ever try buprenorphine again. Some clinicians report that patients have become more likely to request methadone, despite its inconveniences. Kawasaki, who works at a clinic that offers both methadone and buprenorphine, says she's had trouble enrolling patients in a clinical trial about buprenorphine induction because her patients are opting for the drug less likely to cause withdrawal symptoms. Though the phenomenon is widespread, doctors haven't reached a consensus about how to move forward, nor have they received much guidance from medical societies and local health officials, leaving doctors to rely informally on word of mouth, email chains, and new scientific papers. Any strategy that works is promising, but the fact that it's become harder for doctors to prescribe buprenorphine is concerning in its own right. While the medication is highly effective, it's also tightly regulated, meaning convincing doctors who aren't addiction specialists to prescribe it has long been challenging. The newfound difficulties, he said, risk reversing recent progress. Okay, well, next up, a very closely related story that might offer some solution to the problems in that previous story. This from Stat News. Top U.S. addiction researcher calls for broad deregulation of methadone. The U.S. government's top addiction researcher is calling for broad deregulation of methadone, a key drug used to treat opioid use disorder. American doctors should, quote, absolutely be allowed to prescribe methadone directly to patients, Nora Volkow, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, said last Wednesday. There's absolutely no reason why not, Volkow said. There are countries where physicians are providing methadone and the outcomes are actually as good as they get at methadone clinics. Falco's comments, which came at the annual STAT Summit, represent perhaps the strongest call yet from a high-profile government official in favor of allowing far broader access to methadone. Currently, though, methadone can only be prescribed at specialized methadone clinics known as opioid treatment facilities, or OTPs. Patients are often required to show up at the clinic every morning to receive a single methadone dose and participate in counseling. Methadone is underutilized in part because it requires such stringent conditions in order to be prescribed, Volkow says. We have a pretty powerful health structure in the United States, and we should optimize it to maximize access to treatment for people with substance use disorders or other conditions, and that includes methadone. Advocates for expanding methadone access have become more vocal in recent years as the U.S. addiction epidemic has worsened. Currently, over 107,000 Americans die of drug overdoses each year. More than 80,000 of those deaths involve opioids. Additionally, as the powerful synthetic opioid fentanyl has permeated the U.S. drug supply, physicians have reported challenges using buprenorphine, another medication used to treat opioid addiction, making methadone's role all the more important. Volkow went further, also advocating for pharmacists to be allowed to dispense methadone to patients in consultation with a physician. Despite calls for expanding access, however, the methadone clinic industry has shown strong resistance to making the medication available outside the context of their opioid treatment facilities. Yeah, surprise, surprise. Such a move could yield poor treatment outcomes, they've warned, and even lead to methadone overdoses. Methadone itself is an opioid sometimes used to treat pain. There were 5,500 to 6,000 methadone-specific deaths from 1999 to 2016. Okay, I just want to stop and say, while that's not insignificant, 6,000 overdoses in 16 years is a tiny fraction of the number of opioid deaths. But of course, this trade group representing methadone clinics said, we do not want to exacerbate the problem we've already got. Roughly 3% of opioid overdoses involve methadone, according to recent NIDA estimate. Though it's not clear how many of those involved other opioids and whether in those cases methadone was prescribed for pain or addiction or obtained illegally. At the STAT Summit, Volkow also gave her de facto endorsement to the practice of supervised injection, essentially specialized facilities that allow people who use drugs to do so in the presence of trained health professionals ready to step in and reverse potential overdoses. I am a scientist and I always deal with data, Volkow said. but some data is available, she noted, from facilities that have opened in other countries, including Canada and Australia. The ones that have done the research have shown that it saved a significant percentage of patients from overdosing, she said. Those conditions do document that, in those circumstances, it can save lives. Volkow's comments come as the Department of Justice, at the direction of President Biden, weighs whether to drop a 2019 lawsuit filed by Trump administration lawyers that would prevent a supervised injection facility in Philadelphia from legally opening. Some harm reduction advocates have also called for the federal government to endorse supervised injection sites, but they remain a hot-button political issue, typically among Republican politicians, but in some progressive strongholds too. In August, Governor Gavin Newsom, Democrat of California, vetoed a bill that would have let the state launch a trial network of supervised injection sites, citing potential, quote, unintended consequences. Amid broader calls for rethinking the language Americans use when discussing addiction and drug use, Valco also re-upped her years-long push to rename the institute she has run since 2003. Abuse, she has said, implies that people with addiction are making active, considered choices each time they use drugs. The acronym should remain the same, she argued, but its full title should change to the National Institute of Drugs and Addiction. Upon taking power, the Biden administration also called for the institute's name to be changed, but such a move requires approval from Congress. I'm very optimistic that they'll change it, Valco said. Okay, well, next up, I want to switch gears and talk about suicide deaths by guns. This from Medical Express. Unsecured handguns account for the majority of firearm suicide deaths in the United States, study finds. When people in the United States die by firearm suicide, they most frequently use handguns, many of which are stored loaded and unlocked, according to a Rutgers study. Researchers whose findings are published in death studies examined data from the National Violent Death Reporting System to examine the deaths of 117,126 individuals who died by firearm suicide between 2003 and 2018. Details about the circumstances of the deaths were recorded in death scene narratives, which the research team used in combination with information from death certificates and interviews with loved ones of the decedents to determine information regarding the type of firearm used, how that firearm had been stored, and where on their bodies the individual shot themselves. In the majority of the deaths, the victims use a handgun, 65%, that they themselves own, 77%, which was stored loaded, 63%, and unlocked, 59%. The large majority of individuals died from wounds to the head, 81%, with chest injuries accounting for the bulk of the remaining deaths. Men were twice as likely as women to use a rifle in their death and were more likely to store their firearm unlocked. Younger individuals also were more likely to have used firearms that had been stored and unlocked, which the researchers say may indicate they were accessing unsecured firearms owned by their parents. These results highlight that, more often than not, unsecured handguns are the driving force in firearm suicide in America, said senior author Michael Anestis, executive director of the New Jersey Gun Violence Research Center at Rutgers and an associate professor at Rutgers School of Public Health. Nationwide, firearms accounted for more than half of all suicide deaths each year, and research has repeatedly demonstrated the risk of death by suicide is elevated for every individual living in a home with firearms. The researchers say to minimize this risk, tools like lethal means counseling is needed to ensure that individuals store their firearms securely, that is, locked and unloaded. Policies that promote legal storage of firearms away from home, they say, should also be considered. These findings highlight the powerful role that secure firearm storage could play in firearm suicide prevention, including our efforts to prevent suicide among children and adolescents who might otherwise access their parents' unsecured firearms. Okay, gun owners, store your weapons responsibly. Okay, well, I want to switch gears again and switch to a couple stories about premature births. This from The Hill. Premature births at highest point since 2007, says Marcha Times. Premature births in the United States in 2021 reached their highest point since 2007, according to the March of Dimes report card on maternal and infant health. In 2021, 10.5% of babies born in the U.S. were premature or born before 37 weeks of gestational age, a 4% increase from 2020. Just four states saw a decrease in premature births. Babies born early are more likely to face health issues than babies born around 40 weeks, and complications can persist into adulthood. The U.S. overall received a D-plus on a report card, a notch lower than its C-minus rating in 2020. Our data reveals that racial differences in birth outcomes persist in the U.S. Infants born to Black and Native American moms are 62% more likely to be born preterm than those born to white women. March of Dimes calls on Congress to take a number of steps to shore up health care for women and babies, like permanently extending Medicaid postpartum coverage to 12 months after birth and passing legislation to expand access to midwifery care. And turning more locally, the premature birth grade for Ohio was D+, similar to the national level, the slightly higher preterm birth rate of 10.6% compared to the national rate of 10.5%. Lucas County got an F, coming in at 12.0% preterm births. And in an interesting related story, this from Medical Express, skin-to-skin contact key for premature baby survival, World Health Organization says in Shift. Skin-to-skin contact is key to improving survival of premature and small babies, the World Health Organization said last Tuesday in a major overhaul of policy that previously called for the use of incubators. The new guidelines mark a major turnaround in the way the UN Health Agency recommends neonatal intensive care be provided to teeny babies. Allowing mothers or other caregivers in preterm babies to remain close from the start without separation boosts the chance of survival, Karen Edmond, World Health Organization medical officer and pediatrician, told reporters in Geneva. The first embrace with a parent is not only emotionally important, but also absolutely critical for improving chances of survival and health outcomes for small and premature babies. Immediate skin-to-skin contact should be provided, even for babies who are unwell with breathing difficulties. They too need the close contact from their mother from birth. The WHO describes prematurity as an urgent public health issue, with an estimated 15 million babies born preterm each year, accounting for about 1 in 10 births. And for the first time ever, the guidelines also include recommendations on family involvement, including a call for intensive care units to restructure to allow the mother and baby to stay together. It is important, Edmond said, to keep the baby in skin-to-skin contact 24/7, even if the baby needs to be in intensive care. The guidelines also propose for the first time that increased emotional and financial support be given to caregivers of preterm babies. Parental leave is a must to help families care for the infant, Edmond said, adding that caregivers of preterm babies should be offered sufficient financial and workplace support, as well as home visits after discharge. So the stubbornness of the rate of preterm babies has been a long time. And this is really great that you can get to some of these actually sort of social determinants and the fact that moms need support, need workplace support, home visits, that type of thing, and changes in the intensive care units. This actually reminds me of kind of an odd epiphany that I had being trained in nutrition. There's a condition called failure to thrive where kids just don't grow. And typically, you know, in a medical setting, this is often seen as a nutritional problem. But often you put the kid in the hospital and they start to grow and they go home and they fail to thrive again. And usually it's because it comes some kind of neglect or abuse rather than nutrition. If a baby does not get physical contact, care, and affection, the baby will not grow. Doesn't matter what you feed it. This is an important thing, important part of being a human being. And switching to the other end of life, we should also not drug up old people because it seems convenient to us or their providers. This from the Washington Post. Epilepsy drugs as chemical restraint on rise in nursing homes. Government policies aimed at curbing excessive use of powerful psychiatric drugs for dementia patients in nursing homes are probably having unintended side effect. Greater use of anti-seizure medications, a government report said last Thursday. The evidence released by the Office of Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services indicates physicians specializing in nursing home care may have traded one controversial practice for another in response to regulatory scrutiny, seeking to sedate dementia patients with anticonvulsant medications rather than antipsychotics. The Office of Inspector General's report studied prescribing patterns for drugs that work in the brain, called psychotropics. It focused on drugs given to nursing home residents from 2011 to 2019, measuring the effect of a government program begun in 2012 to reduce the widespread use of antipsychotic drugs in these facilities. Overall use of psychotropic drugs did not increase, but rather the use of psychotropic drugs shifted toward a different category, the report stated. It also found that nursing homes with fewer hours worked by a registered nurse and those with more low-income patients use measurably greater proportions of all categories of drugs that work in the brain, including antidepressants. The analysis highlights a long-standing issue. how nursing homes often do not provide the most appropriate care for residents with dementia. The inappropriate use of dangerous and powerful medications hasn't really changed, and that is really disturbing, said Richard Mollett, Executive Director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition, a group that is critical of industry practices. On one hand, nursing homes must keep patients and caregivers safe from violent behavior that jeopardizes them or others, but too often experts say patients with dementia are drugged as a matter of convenience for the nursing home staff or to reduce annoying behavior, not for safety reasons. In response to a campaign launched in 2012 by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which regulates nursing homes, use of antipsychotic drugs declined from 31% of nursing home residents to 22% from 2011 to 2019, the report found. But in the same period, the use of anticonvulsants rose from 28% of residents to 40%. A report published this month in the Journal of American Geriatric Society had similar findings. It said two anticonvulsant drugs were increasingly being used in nursing homes, valproic acid or valproate, which is known under the brand names Depakote and Depakine, and gabapentin, also known as Neurontin, which has frequently been prescribed for pain. Critics of the practice known as chemical restraint says it is inhumane if not practiced appropriately. You want them to have the best quality of life possible and approach care in a positive and respectful way that gives people dignity, said Ryan Carnahan, a University of Iowa professor and expert in the use of psychiatric drugs for elderly patients. To just snow them and knock them out is not the outcome we should be going for. No drugs have been approved to treat dementia caused by Alzheimer's or other brain diseases. Physicians are permitted to prescribe medications, quote, off-label, which means for conditions outside their approved use. But the use of drugs to sedate dementia patients exposes them to dangerous potential side effects. Antipsychotics carrying a black box warning from the Food and Drug Administration because of the risk of stroke, heart attack, diabetes, Parkinsonism, and falls. Some anticonvulsants carry the risk of liver toxicity and inflammation of the pancreas. So that is a huge loophole, the off-label thing, when you're talking about having a third or more of the population receiving these drugs that aren't even approved for that purpose. Yikes. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on 106.1 FM Toledo, WAKT We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, I have another story that gets at the interface between healthcare providers and patients. This from Medical Express. Most cancer patients want access to complementary therapies before treatment. Nearly two-thirds, 62% of people with cancer, want to know about complementary therapies such as exercise, nutrition counseling, massage, and meditation before starting conventional treatment. But only 33% of oncologists agree with that timeline, according to a new survey conducted on behalf of Samueli Foundation. Patients want more information about their options so they can make informed decisions about their overall treatment, both traditional and complementary together, said Wayne Jonas, Executive Director of Integrative Health Programs at Samueli Foundation. It's up to providers to engage in conversations with their parents to better understand the whole person who is coming for care and to foster treatment plans catered to individuals. The survey of more than 1,000 patients who were diagnosed with cancer within the past 2 years and 150 oncologists revealed strong patient preference for cancer care that integrates supplemental approaches. 40% of cancer patients said they would have chosen a hospital that offered complementary therapies if they could go back in time. More than one-third, 35%, report their satisfaction would have increased if their healthcare team had offered them complementary services, such as mental health supportive therapy, mindfulness, and spiritual services, in addition to traditional treatments like radiation and chemotherapy. More than three-quarters of oncologists, 76%, said they wanted to learn more about the benefits of complementary therapies combined with traditional approaches, treatments, but many cited barriers to pursuing integrative approaches, including lack of insurance reimbursement, 49%, lack of staff, 39%, a misperception that patients are not interested, 32%, and a lack of time to fit these options into conversations with patients, 31%. It's clear that clinicians, insurers, and hospitals need to both learn about and offer more access to information and treatment options, said Jonas. Patients and oncologists want to see benefits of treating the whole person instead of just a disease, yet many systems are established in a way that prevents that kind of care. 50% of patients and 60% of oncologists strongly agree that integrative oncology can help manage side effects and improve overall well-being, both during and after treatment. Additionally, 40% of patients and oncologists alike believe that adding complementary therapies improve treatment outcomes and overall survival compared to using medical treatments alone. Urban patients, 55%, and patients age 18 to 50, 72%, say this much more often than rural patients at 35%, and those 75 and older at only 23%. Overall, 66% of cancer patients report using at least one complementary therapy, yet a majority never communicated this information to their oncologist. The most reported complementary therapies used were nutrition consultation, 35%, mental health supportive therapy, 27%, exercise consultation, 26%, meditation or mindfulness, 26%, and spiritual services, 25%. For patients, more than one quarter said the top two barriers to using complementary approaches are their lack of knowledge of these treatments and their treating institutions not offering this option. Hospitals and providers need to offer more care options alongside traditional cancer treatments to enhance patient satisfaction and improve quality and length of life for persons with cancer, said Jonas. By offering integrative healthcare options, medical providers can meet the exploding demand from patients. It's up to us as healthcare providers to learn about and advocate for more treatment options that go beyond just pills and procedures. Amen. Okay, well, next up, let's turn to some medical care that could be used more effectively. This from USA Today. Lung cancer screening saves lives. So why do so few of those at risk get one? Lung cancer screening has proven useful, has been proven to save lives. But according to a new study, only 5.8% of people eligible for free low-dose CT scan actually get screened for lung cancer, far below levels seen for colorectal, breast, and cervical cancer screens. Lung cancer remains the deadliest cancer in the United States, claiming an estimated 130,000 lives this year. About 60% are caught after the tumor has spread beyond the lung and is past the point of being cured, said Zach Jump, National Senior Research Director for Epidemiology and Statistics with the American Lung Association, who helped lead the new study. Still, Jump said he's seen the five-year survival rate from lung cancer climb from about 15% when he started working for the Lung Association to more than 25% today. Catching tumors early offers the possibility of even more lives saved, he said. Studies show screening leads to at least a 20% reduction in death from lung cancer. Screening, which involves a quick CT scan fully clothed with no advanced preparation, has only been recommended by the federal government since 2014. In March 2021, criteria were modified to nearly double the number of people eligible for the free scan. Now, anyone can get the free screen if they are between ages 50 to 80, currently smoke or have quit within the past 15 years, and have a 20-pack-year smoking history, meaning they smoked at least 20 cigarettes a day for 20 years or 10 cigarettes a day for 40 years. There's a more complicated list of criteria than for other cancer screens, which might be one reason people have been slow to adopt lung cancer screening. In a recent study, the Veterans Health Administration from 2013 to 2021, researchers found that the facility where a patient received care accounted for 36% of the variation in screening rates, and the doctor accounted for 19% of the difference, more than personal characteristics of the veteran. Andrea Burundi Kitts remembers her husband, a heavy smoker, saying, "I did this to myself," when he was diagnosed with lung cancer a decade ago. Kitts, who has been a lung cancer advocate since her husband's death, initially thought high-risk people like her husband would, quote, run to their doctors to get screened. But often she has to convince people to get screened. "I've had people tell me lung cancer is a death sentence. Why would I want to know?" New treatments have made significant advances against the disease, and early detection is the best predictor of long-term survival. 80% of cancers detected with screening are at an early stage when it's potentially curable, she said, while 75% of cancers found without screening are at later stages with fewer treatment options. "Lack of lung cancer screening is more about systems failing patients than patients failing to show up for tests," said Dr. Jacob Sands, a lung cancer specialist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. "Amongst the medical community, I think there's a history of blaming patients for bad stuff, as opposed to recognizing the flaws within our own system," he said. "Lack of awareness also limits lung cancer screening," said Jeffrey Yang, a thoracic surgeon at Massachusetts General Hospital. "When we go out in the community and we teach people about lung cancer screening, nobody's heard of it," he said. "While mammogram appointments don't require prior approval from a primary care doctor, lung cancer screening usually does," said Yang, "which is another barrier. As with any screen, the low-dose CT scan can yield false positives, requiring further testing to prove the person doesn't have lung cancer. Nearly 13% of initial tests are false positives, with the person recommended for follow-up or more invasive testing. For repeat scans, the figure is closer to 5%. So that is pretty significant when you get that many number of false positives. It creates anxiety and requires more testing. But overall, it saved lives and a good thing. So more lung cancer screening for those eligible. Okay, well, next up, let's switch to an area where medicine is increasingly failing. The world needs new antibiotics. A proposed U.S. program to develop them would pay off 28 to 1. Antimicrobial drugs form the background of backbone of modern medicine, but they don't last forever. The game clock on antibiotic efficiency starts ticking down from the moment of their first use, and evolutionary processes start selecting for the mutations which can survive antibiotic exposure, allowing antimicrobial resistance to emerge and spread. Already, antimicrobial resistance kills an estimated 35,000 Americans each year and 1.27 million people worldwide. Despite the threat of antimicrobial resistance, the research and development pipeline for new antimicrobials is sparse. An array of market failures stop private companies from capturing a sufficient return on investment, despite the very high social value of new antimicrobials. Widespread recognition of these market failures has driven a search for creative solutions and generated enthusiasm for use of pull mechanisms, which would help incentivize antibiotic development. One particularly promising pull approach, so-called subscription models, would offer guaranteed annual payments to successful antibiotic developers delinked from sales volumes. So in other words, you don't have to have massive use to make money. You develop a good drug and use it only when it's necessary. The good news is that this approach has already captured the attention of U.S. lawmakers. A subscription-based pull mechanism is included in the pending Pasteur Act, which was introduced by lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate and endorsed in President Biden's 2023 budget request. And the great news for the U.S. and the world is that such an investment would offer a massive payoff. In a new paper, we estimate the expected return on investment for such a program. That is an ambitious new program to incentivize antibiotic development via a U.S. government subscription-based pull mechanism. We don't explicitly model the Pasteur Act. Instead, we construct an illustrative example from first principles, with parameters drawn where possible from the literature, and using some simplifying and deliberately conservative assumptions about program design and remuneration. Nevertheless, the results are indicative for the Pasteur Act itself or any other similar initiative. From the U.S. perspective alone, we find that such a program is likely to offer an extraordinary return on investment in both the short and long term. Considering both the value of averted death and disease and associated hospital costs, every dollar invested would yield $6 of value over the program's first 10 years and $28 over a 30-year time horizon. 20,000 American lives would be saved over the next decade and 383,000 over the next 30 years. The global impact is even bigger. From a global perspective, exclusively considering the health value of disability-adjusted life years that are averted, the return on investment is even larger. We expect other G7 countries to pay their fair share of the global incentive payments, so the global cost is higher than the American contribution. But the global impact is enormous. 518,000 lives saved over the next decade and almost 10 million by 2053. This implies a 30-year global return of investment of 125 to 1. And sensitivity analysis suggests that the overall findings, that is, very high social returns, remains robust under a wide variety of alternative assumptions and scenarios. Our paper suggests that a subscription program for new antibiotics would protect American citizens, yield huge returns, and create a safer, healthier world. And we urge world leaders, including here in the U.S., to act now to boost our shared health future. Okay, well, I want to close up regular reporting this episode with three stories in the global context. First up from Axios, water insecurity is stressing mental health. Hundreds of millions of people around the world lack reliable access to safe water, an escalating crisis with a potentially profound impact on their mental health. Why it matters. Similar to food insecurity, water insecurity has been linked to depression, anxiety, and increased rates of violence, and is considered one of the greatest threats facing humans, several scientists tell Axios. The impact? Mental health comes from mental health outcomes from water insecurity are still being studied, but many scientists think experience of resource insecurity seem to track closely with PTSD, anxiety, and depression. And more World Health News, this is from Reuters. Nearly half of world population suffers from oral diseases, says World Health Organization. Nearly half of the world's population, or 3.5 billion people, suffer from oral diseases, the majority of them in low and middle-income countries, the World Health Organization said last Thursday. The most common oral illnesses are tooth decay, severe gum disease, tooth loss, and oral cancers, with untreated tooth decay affecting nearly 2.5 billion people. About 380,000 new cases of oral cancers are diagnosed every year. The World Health Organization cited large out-of-pocket expenditures and the unavailability of highly specialized dental equipment in primary healthcare facilities as two of the reasons for the high prevalence of oral diseases, especially in poor countries. Oral health has long been neglected in global health, but many oral diseases can be prevented, said the WHO Director General. The agency suggested countries include equitable oral health services as part of their national planning and integrate oral health services into our primary healthcare models, while also improving access to affordable fluoride toothpaste, among other measures. And this is another sad example of that. Healthcare and medical care doesn't seem to really involve things above the neck, meaning like dental care, vision care, and mental health care doesn't seem to be included in the normal physical health model of medical care. And you can add to that hearing care. That brings up the next story from Medical Express. Over a billion young people are potentially at risk of hearing loss from headphones, earbuds, loud music venues. More than 1 billion teens and young people are potentially at risk of hearing loss because of their use of headphones and earbuds in attendance at loud music venues, concludes a pooled data analysis of the available evidence published in the open access journal, British Medical Journal Global Health. Governments around the world need to urgently prioritize safe listening policies to safeguard hearing, says the researchers. The World Health Organization estimates that over 430 million people worldwide currently have disabling hearing loss. Young people are particularly vulnerable because of their use of personal listening devices, such as smartphones, headphones, and earbuds, in attendance at loud music venues amid poor regulatory enforcement. Previously published research suggests that personal listening devices users often choose volumes as high as 105 decibels, while average sound levels at entertainment venues range from 104 to 112 decibels. Exceeding permissible levels, that is 80 decibels for adults and 75 decibels for children, even if for very short periods of time. The pooled data analysis indicates that the prevalence of unsafe listening practices from personal listening device use and attendance at loud entertainment venues is common worldwide, 24% for personal listening device use and 48% for attendance at loud entertainment venues. This is for among teens and young people. Based on these figures, the researchers estimated the global number of teens and young adults who could potentially be at risk of hearing loss as a result ranges from 670 million to 1.35 billion. Listen up, folks. Okay, well, next up we have the feature bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give you a link at the end of the list, and this week it's a pretty long list, 24 bonus articles. First up, a couple articles related to the Colorado Springs shooting. One, transgender Americans facing epidemic of violence, says Human Rights Campaign. Two, clear spike in anti-trans rhetoric sets stage for violence like Colorado Springs shooting. Great article outlining how there's a direct connection between this hate speech and rhetoric and actual violence. And also related to that, bonus article 3, health harms of mass shootings ripple across communities. And this is interesting because there's kind of two epidemics. Most gun violence is actually in communities that have where gun violence is endemic, where you have a constant rate of unacceptable levels of violence. That's most gun violence occurs in those settings, and that's much of the country. But mass shootings tend to happen often in communities that don't necessarily have high rates across the board all the time. So there's kind of a difference in the way these two are dealt with. But this article particularly deals with the special ripple effects and health harms that happen of mass shootings. And Colorado Springs is a perfect example of where there's going to be long-term health harms from the single mass shooting. Switching to abortion women's health care issues, bonus article 4, mental crises excluded from some state abortion exemptions. Another example where physical and mental health are not seen as similar and don't get treated equally. People can have suicide attempts when they're pregnant or have big psychiatric issues, and that doesn't affect a lot of the state abortion exemptions, even when it includes the health of the mother. And 5, anti-abortion pregnancy centers are deceiving women. They need to know that. This is a good editorial basically outlining the fact that these pregnancy centers are deceiving women and not offering the full range of services and informed consent to make a decision for themselves. And an interesting take on all this is Article 6. We argue over the right to end pregnancy, but who's fighting for the right to begin pregnancy? So this is really another area where it doesn't get as much attention, but like in vitro fertilization is really expensive. It's typically not covered by insurance and has very differential access. In other words, you have to have a lot of resources to be able to access these kind of services. So that's an issue. And another related story, bonus article 7, the quality of human sperm has dropped by half in the last 50 years. So both men and women are having problems with fertility, which raises the whole issue of access to services to in vitro fertilization for those folks who want to have a family. And another family planning story, article 8, patient mistrust and poor access hamper federal efforts to overhaul family planning. So this is the historical poor treatment, particularly of women of color in family planning, that it makes it very difficult to expand efforts when you have a lot of mistrust. Article 9, redressing the racial health gap through reparations. Now this is a good overview from Harvard that basically talks about all the social determinants that are linked up with the racial health gap and how reparations might address some of those health gaps. And in another racial, I think, disparity article, number 10, why doesn't the U.S. have more black doctors? I've reported on this before, but a good backgrounder. And another one, 11, brains of black Americans age faster, study says, with racial stressors a likely factor. Lifelong stress of racial discrimination ages people faster. And 12, in a Republican-led House, probing science agencies tops the agenda. So this is a good overview of both the science and health agenda that Republicans may have an impact on. And switching to other health care, 13, how banks and private equity cash in when patients can't pay their medical bills. Not surprising, the money changers have moved in and have monetized medical debt. They're not lending them money. They're lending them money to pay their bill, but then they take over and charge ridiculous rates, whereas historically, often a lot of hospitals have offered like 0%, you know, while you're paying your bill, as long as you're paying something, that type of thing. And back a couple articles on Medicare Advantage, the disaster that it is. Article 14, audits hidden until now reveal millions in Medicare Advantage overcharges. And actually, when you generalize this to all of Medicare Advantage, these particular audits, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. And this is audits that could only be taken when Kaiser Health News sued the federal government in order to get access to records. And another long article that gets at the failures of Medicare Advantage. 15, replace the failure of Medicare Advantage with Medicare Part F. So one potential solution to upgrade Medicare Advantage. Article 16, older and disabled Americans are languishing for years on waiting lists for home care. Why don't we fix this? 17, the end of vaccines at warp speed. Financial and bureaucratic barriers in the United States mean that the next generation of COVID vaccines may well be designed here, but used elsewhere. 18, this one for the holidays, an interesting perspective, how to think like an aerosol scientist this holiday season to stay healthy, which of course, indoor air circulation is an important part of infectious disease, respiratory disease prevention. Another interesting story, 19, imaging study shows marijuana smokers have higher rates of emphysema and airway disease than tobacco smokers. So marijuana is not some miracle cure. It damages your lungs, perhaps even more than tobacco smoking. 20, large concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, are known polluters. Here's why EPA permits only cover one-third. And 21, potatoes can be part of a healthy diet. Woohoo! I'm a big fan of potatoes. Think they're the most underrated, and this is an interesting study that shows that exactly to be the case. And another interesting nutrition one, 22, why all athletes should eat plant-based diets for performance and health. 23, no more mad cow worries. Banned blood donors can give again. This is one of my personal favorites. This is crazy because decades ago there was mad cow in England. If you were in England during that time, they banned people for decades to give blood. It's this kind of quest for zero risk. That's nuts. Glad to see the Red Cross finally give up on that. And 24, some good news, an unexpected winner in the midterms, public health, a good review of the public health wins. You can view these and all the stories I've reported in this episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.